This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a real pleasure to welcome to Greening of the Great Lakes Bill Moritz, who is the Natural Resources Deputy for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Long career with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, at one time the Wildlife Division Chief. And Bill's here to talk to us about several programs and initiatives at the DNR, including, of course, an update on the Asian carp. Bill, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
Let's start with a bad and good story. I mean, and it's good because you guys, your enforcement divisions were hard at work. But just recently, the Attorney General, Bill Schuette's office, announced felony charges against an Asian carp salesman from Arkansas.
That's correct.
And tell us, and you and the DNR was heavily involved in that investigation.
Yes, we had a tip come in from the public to our law enforcement division that there was an individual selling Asian carp, one of the Asian carp species, which is grass carp, at a local store, in the parking lot of a local store, as a matter of fact.
And now, obviously, this is not a common, we don't hear too much about this, but why in the world would somebody sell an invasive species that's illegal in a store? I mean, what?
Well, the species that he had is commonly called a grass carp, and it consumes lots of vegetation. So in many states, grass carp have been promoted as a way to reduce the vegetation in the pond in your backyard. And Michigan has prohibited the possession of grass carp for many years now. There are still some states that allow the possession of grass carp. But those that allow the possession, they have to be in a genetic state that doesn't allow reproduction. Mm-hmm. So, but Michigan has prohibited them. Clearly, we still have purveyors come into the state selling fish to put into ponds, and grass carp was one that this individual happened to have.
Now, a little bit of background for our listeners who may not be familiar with the story, but your agents actually, it was sort of a sting operation, wasn't it, essentially?
Yeah, the tip came in, the officers went undercover to the site and were able to actually purchase fish from this individual in the parking lot.
Now, some people out there might be thinking, well, this is a minor matter. This is serious business. I mean, this person's been charged with 12 felony counts. What could this person get under a worst-case scenario?
Well, each of the counts were listed is a felony under the state law, and it's a possibility of 2 years in prison and a fine of $2,000 to $20,000 per count.
Now, what about the purchasers of these kinds in this particular case, this particular kind of Asian carp? Are they also subject to penalties as well?
If there's documentation that such a thing occurred, what we tend to do is if we identify Asian carp in a person's pond, we would work with that landowner to eliminate those animals. What we simply don't want to have is Asian carp becoming established in the public waters of the state of Michigan.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of the Asian carp on the broader scale, I mean, what's going on in the bigger picture? I know that the Army Corps of Engineers is speeding up their research due to public pressure. There are lawsuits that have been filed by several Great Lakes states. Mm-hmm. I mean, where are we as we speak this summer?
Well, most people hear about Asian carp associated with the Mississippi River drainage, be it the Illinois River, the Des Moines River, the Mississippi itself, and any of its tributaries. These fish, when they get established in these watersheds, rapidly increase to dominate the entire system and squeeze out all the native fishes and those fish that are popular for fishing. They are moving up through the Illinois drainage, to the point that they're now, just 55 miles from the Great Lakes. And, of course, the Mississippi drainage is connected to our Great Lakes through a canal or a couple of different canals in Illinois that create a real risk. The Army Corps has for years been working on an electric barrier in that canal. Actually, there's two barriers that are in place, and these are electric barriers that repel the fish and keep them coming through. To keep them from coming through. What we're seeing is that those electric systems don't work when the power goes out, and that causes a great deal of concern that those fish could come through and get established in Lake Michigan. And once they're here, they will move all through the Great Lakes system. So Michigan's been very concerned and very active in putting pressure on the Army Corps to make sure that we have a good barrier to prevent grass carp or Asian carp from becoming established in the Great Lakes.
And so the next step essentially is the Army Corps of Engineers has stepped up their research, and they're going to come out with a report. That will be the next phase of this Asian carp issue to see what their recommendations are, I suspect.
That's correct. That's correct.
My guest is Bill Moritz, who is a natural resource deputy for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Bill, let's move from invasive species and Asian carp. I did not realize until recently with the Duck Lake fire in Luce County in the Upper Peninsula, but the DNR has firefighting responsibilities on state lands.
State and private lands, as a matter of fact. We are probably the lead responder for fire throughout the state of Michigan. And, of course, with over 4.5 million acres of state-owned land and that interspersion with private land, we need to have a world-class response organization, and we have that in the Michigan DNR. Yeah, the DNR's had a very busy fire year this year with over 300 fires to date. The Duck Lake fire is actually the third largest in modern history at just over 21,000 acres this year. That would compare with the Mack Lake fire, if you remember that from the early 1980s, which was 25,000, and the Big Seney fire in 1976, that was over 70,000 acres. This year, fire has been on the news a great deal with large-scale fires in New Mexico and in Colorado presently. Michigan, again, is dry like many places, and these fires have been a big concern this year.
I was recently on a plane from Los Angeles to Dallas, and the pilot, as we were flying over, pointed to the smoke and residue of the Colorado fires from our 30,000 feet. I mean, kind of, so the fires are ubiquitous this year. What caused this one in the UP?
This fire started the Thursday before Memorial Day, and it was caused by a lightning strike, a dry storm going through that triggered that, and the conditions were ideal. It's been a very warm and dry spring, and when the storm came through, it came with lots of wind. So once that fire started, we had several lightning strike fires going, but this one really took off and carried and became a big fire literally overnight.
Now, state budgets have been tough. I don't need to tell you this in recent years, and funding has been reduced for many state agencies. When you have to respond to a situation like this, do you have the resources? Do you have to contract outside agencies? What is the situation for getting enough manpower on the ground?
Well, the second part of your question dealt with how we mobilize resources. Today, with tight budgets and shortages of equipment and everything else, the way we approach fire is to do it in a partnership way. So when a big fire comes in, obviously, the first responders are the local volunteer fire departments combined with the state, but we have resources and agreements that we can immediately jump to neighboring states and provinces. We've had a long-time relationship with Ontario, Wisconsin, Minnesota, those sorts of states, that they can mobilize resources to come in. This fire was in a remote part of the Upper Peninsula, and Minnesota DNR provided two aerial water bombers to help fight that fire. National Guard came out that weekend to assist with the fire. So the way to fight big fires today is for multiple states, agencies, units of government to come together and tackle that fire. Within the state, multiple departments of the executive branch come together and work to create a command center, if you will, an emergency management center to respond. And so state police organizes that. But the, for example, Red Cross is part of it. Homeland Security is part of it. Everybody brings tools to the table to help mobilize their resources, not only to fight the fire, but to support the community that's impacted by that fire.
And the Department of Natural Resources coordinates all of that effort.
That's correct. That's correct.
Let's switch to a subject that's kind of a fun one, and we've discussed on the show before. I remember having Chuck Nelson from Michigan State University on the program, and Becky Humphreys talking about the recreation passport, which in my mind is a great idea in terms of funding our beautiful Michigan parks and recreation sites. What is the passport program for our listeners who may not know, and how is it going?
It's a great segue to go from fire to our state park system. Both of those programs in the past had been largely supported by the state's general fund. But over the last 10 or 20 years, a greater part of that burden had been placed on the users of the resource, or in the case of forest fire, the Forest Development Fund. The wood products that come off of the land are paying for our firefighting efforts. Because of the shortage of general fund for our state parks, the park users were looking at a fairly high admission fee, and we came up with this recreation passport as a way for all of the state to support the 101 wonderful parks that are here in the state. What this is when you renew your vehicle registration, you have an opportunity to add an additional $10 to that, which allows you free admission for the year into all the state parks of Michigan. So for a $10 donation, you're really enhancing the parks, and it's required to go to the state parks as well. last year, our goal was to have 24% of vehicle registrations participate in the program, and we met that goal. This year, we're being more aggressive. We'd like 30% of vehicle registrations through an active information campaign, and we're currently running about 27%. So as you and any of your listeners renew their vehicle registrations, please consider adding a P to your decal, which is what comes in the sticker that goes on your license plate, and for $10, enjoy the wonderful state parks.
And I am one of those people that do that. Now, here's a question that I had when I renew, though. Suppose you have a couple of cars in your family. You would have to renew for each one, or
that's correct.
Because it's only the car that has the P designation on it that gets into the park, right?
That is correct.
So if you've got two cars, then it's $20. If you've got one car, it's $10.
Unless you always
either way,
take
it's
the
well worth it's well worth the money. Actually, it's a tax. The way it's been explained earlier, and it made a lot of sense. Even though for a while it was questionable whether the legislature was going to figure all this out, but it's a tax reduction.
That's correct.
I mean, and people are paying a lot less for going to those parks than they would normally, particularly those heavy users, right?
Yes, and park visitation has been up dramatically. This is a great way for folks to take advantage of a low-cost way to enjoy the great outdoors.
And what is your ideal? You're moving up from the 20s into the 30% vehicle registrations. I mean, what ideally would you need to fund these parks the way you would like to fund them?
Well, it's a matter of playing catch-up right now. Yeah. I don't know what the overall goal actually is for total participation, but we would love to have everybody visiting our parks every year.
Yeah. And, of course, why wouldn't they?
That's right.
It's pure Michigan.
And that's the best thing you can possibly do is get outdoors.
My guest is Bill Moritz, who is a Natural Resources Deputy in the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Bill, we've got a couple minutes left here, and I want to talk to you about an area of expertise. You came from the Wildlife Division. You headed it up. You've done work with wolves. You've done work with deer. You've done work with wild turkey, et cetera. Biodiversity is an important thing. Development's an important thing. How do you balance wildlife and development to ensure that we have these species, and how do you ensure that those populations are such that we're not having problems?
Well, dating all the way back to my earliest years in college, people talked about the art of wildlife management. There's plenty of science that informs the decision-making process, but you have to balance all these competing demands for every square foot of land, be it for housing development, be it for wild areas, be it for all these other uses that are out there. The Department of Natural Resources has a responsibility to balance all of that and to make sound policy for the state that protects and ensures that those animals will be there for current and future generations. Now, Proposal G in the mid-1990s said that the Natural Resources Commission has the responsibility for the method and manner of take of those. And so the department provides a great deal of information and then allows a public participation process for folks to come in and comment about what they think about wildlife regulations. So we bring the science to the table, we bring the public attitudes to the table, and that's the way you get effective wildlife management policy.
And wildlife management is not something that's set in stone. It is a fluid process, always evolving.
Yes, and for all that here, there are a diverse number of opinions around every single issue, especially deer.
But with wolves, there tends to be a consensus that the wildlife management on our wolf population has been quite the success.
Yes, we've brought wolves back from being absent from the state to a healthy, thriving population, to the point that earlier this year, wolves were delisted from the federal endangered species list and for all of the Great Lakes. And that will set the stage for future discussions on how we effectively develop a set of tools for managing a wolf population in the context of a fairly populated landscape.
I've been talking with Bill Moritz, who is the Natural Resources Deputy for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Bill, thanks for an update on all the programs, or many of the programs that the DNR is responsible for. Continued success going forward, and maybe we can have you back on again in the not-too-distant future to talk about those wildlife management issues in more detail.
Yeah, there's plenty of topics. I'll be happy to come back.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome to Greening of the Great Lakes, Jeff Cook. Jeff is president of Southwestern Oil Company, which is based in Greenville, Michigan. Also a board member of the Michigan Oil and Gas Association. And also, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this, an MSU grad. Jeff, yeah. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me here, and go green.
And absolutely go green. And congratulations, a daughter recently graduated from Michigan State, a mom who's on the Board of Trustees. I mean, it runs in the family.
Well, absolutely. And my wife was a cheerleader here, so we're about as green as they get.
Well, then you couldn't be in a better spot than
greening of the Great Lakes. What a better topic.
Jeff, we're going to talk about hydraulic fracturing in some depth during this interview, but mm-hmm. In your capacity as a board member of the Michigan Oil and Gas Association, you think in energy all the time. I don't need to tell you, energy's in the news. It's everywhere. People are writing major books on it. I'm mm-hmm. reading Juergen's new book on energy now, which is pretty tough sledding, but mm-hmm. 500 pages long.
Right.
Why is energy so important now? Why is everybody talking about it?
Well, energy's always been important. I mean, it is obviously fuels the economy. But what the reason it's a major topic right now is we're really going through a renaissance in energy production. As little as 5 years ago, the thought was that we had on the natural gas side a 25-year supply of natural gas available to us. With the discovery of natural gas being produced from shale rock, and the drilling that's gone on in those 5 years, we now estimate that we have over a 100-year supply of just natural gas available to us. So all those theories about we need to rid ourselves of the addiction to fossil fuels was an important theory 5 years ago when we thought we had a very finite supply. But now we're finding we've got a 100-year glide slope to different fuels, that it really fundamentally changes the equation here. It's a real game changer. And as an example, in 2008, natural gas prices were as high as $12 an MCF. I mean, and that since 80% of Michigan families heat their houses with natural gas, and it's a major fuel for anyone in the manufacturing business, that $12 is a huge input. Today, the price of natural gas, because of the natural gas is being produced from these shale rocks, is as low. It's right now priced at $2.30 an MCF.
And why is natural gas such a big story for Michigan? I recently looked on a map, and Michigan basically sits on natural gas repositories, the whole state.
Well, potentially. We sit on a couple very large shale formations, one of which is already produced, the Antrim Shale. It's produced in the area from roughly Gaylord over to Alpena. There's about 12,000 Antrim gas wells up there that were drilled in the late 80s, early 90s. They're fairly shallow wells, drilled about 1,300 to 1,500 feet deep, all of which, by the way, were hydraulically fractured back before anyone was paying a real close attention to hydraulic fracturing, and we're done, and we've had no negative impacts from any of those wells. But on top of the Antrim, much deeper formation is the Utica Shale, which in the center of the Michigan Basin is found at around 9 to 10,000 feet deep. And it's a very thick shale, so it has a lot of potential. And that's really what's been in the news lately, the leasing that's been going on around the potential of, we actually had an initial discovery up in Maumee County of natural gas produced from a bottom section of this Utica Shale.
You know, we've talked to a lot of people on this program about hydraulic fracturing,
mm-hmm.
many positive, some skeptical, some negative.
Yeah.
One of the concerns is, and it hasn't been so much with the 12,000 wells you mentioned with the vertical hydraulic
right.
fracturing. It's the new dimension, the horizontal fracturing, that has a lot of people concerned. When that drill bit turns horizontally, I mean, you're drilling for another, 4,000 to 5,000 feet beyond?
Maybe as much as 2 miles.
As much as 2 miles.
Yeah, the typical – Michigan hasn't set on what the well spacing is, kind of a technical thing, but will be in Michigan. But as we're seeing in other basins – it's not unusual to do a 2 mile horizontal leg. So I mean, it would be about a 10,000 foot vertical hole with a 10,000 foot horizontal leg.
But with the horizontal, I mean, you have fewer holes, right?
That's the major advantage. I mean, that's been, you know, as someone in the business who watched, for instance, the Antrim Shale that we just talked about, those wells were drilled one well for every 80 acres, and as a result, we have 12,000 wells currently producing in northern Michigan. One of the big concerns at the time that those wells were drilled was the surface impact. You know, every 80 acres, you were going to have roughly a 1 acre well site. Well, with these deep horizontal wells now, we can drill one well for two sections, and that eliminates about 16 wells. And since the units, the surface location size increases a little bit, it's up to about 4 or 5 acres, but was still a major benefit in terms of lessening surface impact. And quite frankly, the greatest risk, and the people in the DEQ will tell you this as well, the greatest risk for any spills or contamination associated with the hydraulic fracturing fluids is really in the surface handling of the materials. And if we can limit it, if we have fewer wells, we have fewer chances of spills. Now, granted, the hydraulic fracturing on a 2 mile horizontal leg uses much more water, but all the studies show that if you have a spill, you're not going to spill all the fluid. A spill is roughly the same size one well to the next, and if we have fewer surface locations, we have fewer opportunities for problems.
My guest is Jeff Cook, who's president of Southwestern Oil Company, based in Greenville, Michigan. Jeff, when you get out to 2 miles mm-hmm. and horizontal underneath the ground, I mean, other concerns are, you know, how do you monitor that? That's such a vast area in some ways. I mean, how do you ensure that you don't have problems along that horizontal line? With a vertical vertical, it seems like in many ways from an environmental compliance standpoint, it would be easier to monitor the vertical as opposed to underground horizontal.
I don't know that that would actually be true. I mean, the rules are the same. We have to case the well either way.
Steel and cement, right?
Steel and cement. The typical well, first of all, all the wells, whether we're drilling a well that will be hydraulically fractured or just a standard oil and gas well, have to be cased. The initial string of casing is set a minimum of 100 feet below the aquifer that's potentially used in the area. And that's cemented from the bottom of the hole up to the surface.
So wherever that pipe goes through an aquifer, the cement is a reinforcement.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because on all wells, not just hydraulically fractured wells, but on all wells, we want to make sure that what is in the well never comes in contact with other formations. In fact, that's the direct objective of the supervisor of wells here, is to make sure that there isn't any migration of material from one formation into another or from any formation into the aquifer. So all Michigan wells are constructed with that as the major objective in the way the well is engineered. After you set the surface casing, there will be an intermediate string that will go roughly two-thirds of the total depth of the well. That, too, is cemented from the bottom of the hole back to the surface. So now you have two strings of casing separating what's inside the well from any contact with an aquifer or other formation where there could be migration. And then finally, we set a production string that runs down to the total depth of the well, which is also cemented in place. And so now the typical well will have these three barriers from anything in the well coming in contact with anything outside the well. And that's true right on out on the whole horizontal leg, just as it's true on a vertical well. So I don't really see any problem, and we haven't seen any problems.
Any major differences between?
The engineering's the same. The concerns are the same in terms of the department and the rules. So everything is built around isolating what is in the productive formation and coming through the well from coming in contact with anything on its trip to the surface.
You mentioned earlier that this takes the horizontal takes a lot of water.
Yes.
Let's talk about the water. I mean, you've explained how things are secure underground.
Yep.
That water comes back up.
Yep.
It's mixed with sand and certain chemicals that are, in many cases, proprietary. What happens to that water?
The water in Michigan, in some other states has been a problem. In Michigan, all that what we call flowback water, the water that flows back out after the pressure is released from the formation, is put in approved underground storage wells. These are EPA and Michigan approved. There's about 1,400 wells approved for that process in the state of Michigan. And the simplest way to think of it is what comes from the ground, we put back in the ground. So we don't have this issue that we'd seen in some other states of controversy about them going to the water going into wastewater plants or being
and eventually shipped to Ohio.
Well, it may be shipped to Ohio, but if it is, it's going into an underground storage facility.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the idea is whatever it may have picked up in being in the ground is going to go right back into the ground and never come in contact again, because not only is the well cased, but the injection well is cased. So we're protecting it from coming in contact with the aquifer.
As you look down the road, done a lot of reading about reuse of water and our H2O management and that sort of thing. This water that goes into these storage wells, is it there forever? Is there a possibility that the technology would evolve so that that water could be reused in the fracking process?
There is a lot of conversation going on about trying to recycle water. And that is a potential. It's not something being done actively in Michigan right now, but there is a real movement on the part of the supply companies to create chemicals that are greener, have a shorter active life, and trying to mitigate our impact in terms of the ability to recycle this flowback water and reuse it. So all that's being managed and evaluated.
Well, in Michigan, we've never really had an issue with water, but you go out to Vegas or the South, I just got back from Palm Springs, all the talk is about using gray water, recycling your water, reusing the water. I mean, as you know, H2O can be neither created nor destroyed, so why not reuse it?
Well, that's exactly right. And if that's possible, it will be done. Although one of the other things to keep in mind is one of the criticisms that has come up is this: if we inject the water into storage wells, it's gone forever. But we also need to remember that the methane that we produce, mm-hmm. When it's combusted, it creates water vapor.
Right.
And the science tells us that for a BCF, which a typical natural gas well produces around a BCF of gas, mm-hmm. a billion cubic feet, that billion cubic feet will produce roughly 11 million gallons of water in water vapor. So while that frack job that required 5 to 8 million gallons of water to release the methane, mm-hmm. we take that flowback water, put it in a disposal well, the gas well that produces the methane will replace that water in the combustion of that natural gas as it's used by Michigan consumers.
You mentioned a 100-year supply of yeah. oil and natural gas. Some estimates are out there as far as 200, 250. You've seen your 100 years was conservative, but yeah. what about the argument or the point that and it's a point that it resonates with me. We can use oil and natural gas for 100 or 200 years. It's going to be a strong part of our energy portfolio. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be looking at other alternative energy development technologies. I mean, wind, solar, geothermal, all of those things are probably going to play a role in the future.
Oh, absolutely. But I think our obligation is to as we've already seen with the price of natural gas, move
right.
from 12 to 2 or in the last couple of years, move from 6 down to 2. It's going to give us a competitive advantage. While we want to have a full mix, natural gas is going to play a strong role in that just because we're a little bit like the farmers. You know, we're somewhat our own worst enemy in the sense that we've produced so much of this that we've made it very affordable. It's reduced the incomes of a lot of oil and gas companies, but what it'll do is provide very low-cost fuel for the businesses and the homeowners in the United States. As a result, as an example, the state of Ohio just announced, I don't know what one of the chemical companies is opening a new plant there based solely on the idea that of this, the supply of natural gas that's available to them in the past, they would never have gone to that area, but it has an indigenous supply of natural gas as a result of the shale production. And, those are new jobs for the people of the state of Ohio. Our hope is, we're still in the very early stages here in Michigan of the exploration in our shale, but to have that kind of success where our auto companies and other new businesses would benefit from that indigenous supply.
Jeff, last question here for you. What would you say people who are on the fence, who are looking at this issue, look at the economic development advantages, the clean natural gas energy, mm-hmm. the price, all of the things that you've mentioned, maybe are skeptical still of horizontal hydraulic fracturing. I mean, what would you say to those folks out there? Give it a chance? What would be your take-home message?
Well, I wouldn't be give it a chance because we've been doing it for 50 years. Mm-hmm. Because they are just hearing about it now, they think it's new, and it's not new. Mm-hmm. This is something we've been doing for 50 years. As I mentioned, the Antrim gas wells in northern Michigan that were drilled in the late 80s, early 90s, every one of those wells was hydraulically fractured. Mm-hmm. They were fractured, and those wells were at roughly 1,500 feet of depth, mm-hmm. Just below the glacial drift here. So, I mean, they were fairly shallow wells, and we've had no problems of any contamination of water in water wells in northern Michigan, no adverse impacts. So what I'm saying is, I'm saying trust us, but trust us because we have a track record.
And trust us because our agencies have been vigilant, and Michigan standards have been standards that have been adopted by other states.
Precisely. I think it's instructive that the supervisor of wells in the state of Michigan, Hal Fitch, is going around to other states advising them on what their rules and regulations should be as they embrace this shale exploration. I think it's also instructive that when we had this discovery of deep shale gas in Michigan had to do some very minor rewrites to their existing rules to be able to regulate this process, where other states were having to deal with a series
basically
of bills.
Basically do a whole rewrite.
Exactly. Michigan was on top of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the only rule that really of any significance dealt with our use of water, brought Michigan oil operators into the same compliance regimen as any other industrial user in terms of water that we draw to use for the hydraulic fracturing.
So. And as you mentioned, and this could be an entirely new renaissance in America's ability to produce its own energy.
It absolutely
is
a game changer.
Get us off the foreign stuff.
In my opinion, the adage that we need to end our addiction to hydrocarbons is an idea whose time has passed. Mm-hmm. For the foreseeable future, we have strong supplies of natural gas and oil, a direct result of and it's an American innovation that has found this this ability to produce oil and natural gas from this rock that, without the hydrofracking, would not be possible to produce. And we are not only are we producing that for ourselves here by drilling wells in the United States, but we are also exporting that technology to other countries. So this is really an American innovation.
Yeah. I've been talking with Jeff Cook, president, Southwestern Oil Company in Greenville, Michigan, also a member of the board of the Michigan Oil and Gas Association. Jeff, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you are instantly connected to a 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, my guest is Luann Cosma, who is the campaign director for the Committee to Ban Fracking in Michigan. She's heading up a citizen-led ballot initiative to amend the Michigan State Constitution to ban horizontal hydraulic fracturing, which is a process for extracting natural gas, commonly called fracking. Very controversial issue, and Luann, it's great to have you on the program to talk about it.
Thank you.
Why is horizontal fracturing such a threat to Michigan from your perspective?
Well, this is a new technology that the gas and oil industry has developed over the past few years. It really hasn't been around that long. The industry will tell you that they've been fracking for a very long time, and that's only partly true. There is a Cornell professor named Dr. Anthony Ingrassi who has spoken about this issue for a long time and has some really good informational videos on YouTube and such that describes the difference between the historic fracking and what's going on now. And what previously the industry was able to do was drill vertically and somewhat directionally. But the new type of fracking that everyone's talking about that is so threatening all the other states as well as Michigan is a much deeper drilling. And then once it's vertically drilled, it then goes horizontally through the shale or other rock layers for miles. So we're talking about a much deeper drilling system as well as many more toxic chemicals, much more water, and much more sand. So with the network of horizontal frack wells that they plan to do, it's a huge system of an industrialized landscape. And that's what's happened in Pennsylvania. There are over 3,000 of them existing right now, and 10,000 have been permitted. In Michigan, we have just the very beginning of this new type of fracking started, and I can talk about that if you'd like.
Given Michigan's pretty good track record with monitoring natural gas wells that exist now, why not give this a trial period to see if this technology can actually be as safe as the previous technology?
Well, that is a good question. We get it a lot, and actually the track record is not so safe at all. And I'm not the expert at it, but I will point to the expert that we rely on, and that's Dr. Christopher Grobel, G-R-O-B-B-E-L, I think is how he spells it. We have some materials by him on a website for this nonprofit organization that we created last fall called Ban Michigan Fracking, and that's available at banmichiganfracking.org. And he has a presentation that you can see on there that talks about the DEQ record. And Chris worked for the DEQ years ago and continually is called upon for contamination lawsuits as an expert witness. And he points out that actually the track record is terrible and they've stopped keeping track since. And this is actually a study done by the Alliance for the Great Lakes back in 2001 that of the 2,842 known sites of environmental contamination due to oil and gas extraction, about 187 of those sites were due to oil and gas extraction, and only 2% were cleaned up. And so he is continually working on these contamination lawsuits. There have been contamination. So when the DEQ says they have a good track record, that's not true. They're not keeping track. And that's, they've not been keeping track since 1995.
Now, let's talk specifically to the petition. And I'm talking to Lou Ann Cosma, who is a campaign director for the Committee to Ban Fracking in Michigan. You're going for a constitutional amendment, right, which would make this permanent, to ban fracking essentially for all time.
That's right. And the reason why we're going this route is because everyone who wants a ban in other states, we're talking about a ban, we're trying to find ways to make that permanent. And in other states, they're trying different methods, such as banning it locally. So a lot of New York towns and communities, and also in Pennsylvania and Maryland and elsewhere, they're trying to do it locale by locale, using either a zoning ordinance or some other kind of ordinance that would restrict where the drilling takes place, so that there's and wastes, where waste would take place. And then entire states and entire countries have banned it. So France has banned it. Bulgaria has banned it. There are ban movements everywhere that fracking is threatening a location. So New Jersey was the first state really to ban it statewide, and that was back in the summer, last summer, but then the governor there vetoed it. So in this, essentially he made a ban turn into just a temporary moratorium. But just last month, early May, Vermont became the real first state to ban fracking, and the governor passed that legislation. But both of those states, New Jersey and Vermont, passed those bans legislatively. But we don't really think that that can likely happen here in our state, given our political climate. To amend the Constitution, it requires a lot more signatures, and the deadline is July 9. And so we chose that route because the citizens of Michigan can write their own law, not in the Constitution, but just write a law. And that takes a lesser amount of signatures to get on the ballot. But the deadline for that was late May, and we did not have enough time to gather signatures in that time. But most importantly, the reason why we didn't go that route is because of the governor and the legislature that is in place right now. We didn't feel that they would keep that legislation in place, that they could easily undo it, like the governor of New Jersey undid the legislation there.
People who are interested in this constitutional amendment, where can they go how can they sign the petition?
They can only sign it in person because this is a voter-to-voter kind of thing. There's no online version of it. There's no downloading of it. And you have to sign one of the forms that we have printed, so there's no photocopying of the forms. So where to find a petition to sign, you would have to go to our website, letsbanfracking.org, and on there are locations where you can find an event or a place where you can go in and sign. And we have people all over the state working on public sidewalks and such, collecting signatures. And we are doing this all volunteer, I'd like to add. So the other ballot initiatives that are out there are hiring people, and sometimes they're hiring people from out of state. So we're not with that batch of ballot petitions. If you meet a person on the street at an event in Michigan, and it's the Committee to Ban Fracking in Michigan's petition, you should be assured that this person is just truly a volunteer who is, you know, cares very deeply about fracking.
So that's letsbanfracking.org. Look for people circulating the petition. I've been talking with Luann Cosma, who is the campaign director for the Committee to Ban Fracking in Michigan. Luann, let's get back together after July and see how you did.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're listening to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes. Lansing, Michigan-based O'Leary Paint received gold, silver, and bronze honors from Coatings Research Group, Inc. this spring. The research group tested regional, national, and international paint products, and O'Leary products were rated the highest of all 31 paints tested. David O'Leary is president of O'Leary Paint.
Well, we're just really proud to be able to be recognized in a national study that our products came in first, second, and third. It's unusual, and to think that a small guy like that can present in a national study that well, it's pretty unusual. It's never happened before where the same company took first, second, and third. And we've tested very well several times, and then we kind of keep it a secret. And this one put us over the top where it was really worthy of some distinction, where people were calling us from around the country saying they've never seen a study like that.
We belong to a lab group called CRGI, or Coatings Research Group, and it's a lab group of 30 paint companies worldwide, and they test all our raw materials and do the paint testing for us. So we have an independent lab, test our products, and we get a yardstick on how we're doing versus the market. And it's not, rather than us doing the testing, it's an independent lab, so we can trust the results we're getting.
That's O'Leary paint chemist Scott Bauer, who adds,
well, the rankings tell you is that we can produce just as good or better coating than all these large companies that have a giant staff of chemists. Since we're a smaller company, we need to be just as good or better because we don't have the name to push our paint. We have to have the quality behind our product and in the can to make sure that we don't have any problems.
No single paint company has ever taken the top three spots in this rating, says O'Leary.
Well, our focus has always been on the painter, the contractor, industry, and they tend to be very knowledgeable about what they're using. And they didn't need us to tell us that they made a quality product. They know firsthand. But for a homeowner, if you're only doing a project once every 4 years, it's really hard to know. And you rely on studies like this to tell you what kind of a product you're using because you don't have that experience.
Winning first, second, and third place respectively, O'Leary's Duramax 90 line, ceramic coat, and micro-spec paints are locally produced in Lansing, Michigan.
And we manufacture our own paint here. We're the largest paint manufacturer that makes house paint in the state of Michigan. Family owned, and we produce everything right here. So, and we do all our research in the lab and make our own products. So we are producing all our products here for the Michigan market, and everything is formulated in this state and is meant for our climate because it is manufactured here and it is all tested here. So we're not making paint for the whole country. We're making paint for Michigan and northern Indiana. So I am trying to formulate coatings that match our climate and weather our climate very well.
As the largest house paint manufacturer in the state, O'Leary Paint outshone national brands such as Behr and Sherwin-Williams in the 2012 National Paint Ranking. Rating criteria included stain blocking, adhesion, water resistance, and washability, and O'Leary did not receive a poor rating in any category, the only brand to do so.
Bigger isn't necessarily better. We've got the same tools and technology that anybody does, and if you focus on a goal of making a quality product, you can surpass anybody in the industry. It's not that different from a bakery or a restaurant. The largest restaurant doesn't necessarily make the best food. If that were the case, then I think the United States military would be the best restaurant in the country. So I think if you care about quality and you can and we have the raw materials that are available, we can compete with anybody in the world. And we have. And I think that this is proven.
All three of O'Leary's winning products are certified as environmentally responsible paints by GreenWise Paint, a division of Coatings Research Group, Inc.
The big thing now is to make paint greener, lower VOC, which is volatile organic compounds, which evaporate into the air and can produce smog. So we're trying to eliminate or reduce the amount of these because there's a new green building code called LEED. So everybody's trying to get their buildings LEED certified. So we're trying to reduce that amount, be it keep the performance of the coating. Because we can make a zero VOC coating. A lot of times the performance of these zero VOC coatings isn't as good as it is with the conventional VOC. So what we're trying to do is make a midpoint, a very good quality, low odor, with a small amount of VOC, because if we get rid of all the VOC, a lot of times we're starting to lose our performance.
Bauer says quality is the main thing to keep in mind anytime you're embarking on a painting project.
I guess the bigger thing you need to do, you need to buy top quality paint. Everybody makes different lines of paint, and your time is very valuable, and you want your paint to last a long time and look very good. The more you spend on your paint, the better quality coating you're going to get for the money. You're going to have better stain resistance, better durability, better look, better application properties, better hiding, so it should take you less time to put it on and it should look much better and last much longer.
Learn more about O'Leary Paint at O'LearyPaint.com. I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
MSU.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
Sing our love for alma mater.
So what that means is when you graduate from college, we'll help you find your first career. When you move to any city, anywhere, we'll help you connect and settle. If you're mid-career and want to reinvent yourself, we'll help you find a new passion. And if you need advice or a friend anywhere in the world, the MSU Alumni Association will connect you with the 500,000 Spartans out there that are always ready to take your call.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu.
And thy praises
Alumni.msu.edu.
Hi, I'm Kirk Heinze, host of the sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes program. Our major goal is to help answer one of the great questions of our time. How can we leave this planet richer in life and possibility for future generations? From subjects like alternative energy, climate change, biodiversity, and cultural preservation, we ask leaders in industry, academia, and the government about the key relationships between environmental, economic, and social sustainability. How do these areas support one another as we work to improve our world?
Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.